Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation. Welcome back to Power Athlete Radio, Dr. Matt Zanis. He has an undergraduate degree from the University of Pittsburgh and a doctorate of physical therapy from Duke. More importantly, he's a Block 1 coach, and he practices a little jiu-jitsu on the side. But when he's not treating clients in Scottsdale, Arizona, he's traveling the world working with shooting sports athletes as the head of performance for USA Shooting. We're going to get into a lot of things as this one kind of goes all over the map, as tends to happen on Power Athlete Radio. So we're happy to welcome back Dr. Zanis. Hey, welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. I'm John Wellborn, and I'm joined by Dr. Matt Zanis.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, dude, it's great. I feel like we're getting so much Zanis time. I'm so excited about it.
This is fantastic. I guess I should actually talk in the mic. Like, yeah, it's not my first time.
Yeah, no, they're good mics.
Yeah,
dude. So, you came into town. We did a little pre-recording for this, and then last night we got a chance to go to jiu-jitsu, which was a lot of fun. First time we rolled together, and then we got to go eat some steaks, which was even better.
Yeah. That was a great experience. We were looking to do that, last December when I came in, and we ended up in that giant traffic jam and in traffic for like an hour and 45 minutes. And I just remember all that disappointment on your face.
Well, it's fun. I think it's a good community of guys, and like the people that go, I made a joke about it. If you need 25 new friends, join a jiu-jitsu gym. Mm-hmm. But what'd you think of Shanji's coaching?
It was great. Yeah, I love the way that it was kind of like the chunking method. Like, he broke everything down really nice and then gave you the opportunity to express yourself.
Yeah, and then he comes around and goes, "What are you doing?" He gets like mad at me at everything. He's
You go rogue, though. you do things that you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, no, I'm fucking outside the box. Shanji's a great coach. I mean, he's one of the best to ever do it. I mean, you know, Shanji Habero is just, I mean, like, dude, like, it's funny. I didn't necessarily know. And then, like, periodically on Flow and different things, like, his, like, matches will pop up, and the dude's an absolute savage. I mean, he killed people for, like, 20 years.
Well, it's unbelievable. Even when he's just coaching and demonstrating, it's so smooth. It looks like artwork.
Yeah.
Like, unfolding.
Yeah, it's like he's been doing it his whole life.
Yeah, weird like that, huh?
Fucking weird, like mastery.
It's all ingrained.
Yeah. And then there's, like, a slight disappointment and anger that everything, like, why is this so hard for you? I'm like, God damn you. Fucker. But we had a lot of fun, and then we got a chance to go eat some steaks with Matt Pollock, which was fun. So we'll give him a shout out. He got his blue belt yesterday. Mm-hmm. So he competed in a local contest and smashed some people, which I think is hysterical that he competed as a white belt as a Power 5 wrestler at both Cornell and Hofstra.
Seems fair. Yeah, it's okay. He's just a jacked former Division I wrestler. It's okay. Yeah.
And he shows up with a white belt and is just smashing some dad bod dudes. And these guys were probably like, what the fuck is this guy doing? And he wrestled for a total of 4 minutes. But then he got his belt. So we went out and had some drinks with him and ate some steaks. And that was a good time. But as much as I love seeing you and reminiscing, mm-hmm. what I really wanted to talk about today on the podcast is really just what people come to you for. I mean, like, what are mm-hmm. the top things? I kind of, it's a loaded question because I know, but like the three things that are you're most reached out to when you're working with your athletes through the general pop or just, you know, through the interwebs, mm-hmm. when people reach out, like those three things are pretty universal. Like 80 to 90% of all the people can kind of fall into these three buckets.
Well, you know, my superpower is pattern recognition. So this really kind of falls
into that. Fuck you.
Oh, come on.
Dude, you guys were like trying to make me seem like an OCD weirdo last night that I like, as you guys might know, I am constantly searching for patterns. And the way this happened is it's from football, 100% from football. So when you run up to the line of scrimmage, like as soon as we would run up, we would call the defense. The center would call the defense, like 3-4, they're doing this. You call the mic. And we all knew the defenses. And as you go, you take a mental snapshot because I know what the defense should look like. There's a shade, there's a 3, there's a 5, there's a 7. I know where the backers play. And then you start looking for things that are outside of – like what they should be or outside like the normal mm-hmm. pattern. So then all of a sudden I'm looking and I'm like, okay, hey, this guy's cheated here. He's cheated here. And I just use pattern recognition mm-hmm. to try to pick up games, to look for blitzes. And then all of a sudden you see the guy bounce. And all of a sudden I know that, you know, when they all of a sudden click this guy off and he goes in motion, I know how they're going to reset the defense. And if they don't reset the defense and they bring somebody down, then all of a sudden you know the different coverages. And you just get obsessed with looking for like what is different. Mm-hmm. It's the what is Waldo.
Yeah.
You're looking at the screen. You're looking for Waldo. And you almost become a little OCD because you watch so much film. And I know exactly the tendencies. And so I know that in this defense, when we run this play, that this is how they should react. And if they don't, then you know that something's up. And, you know, we'd like give the spot guy brow. It was always like. And that pattern recognition just became like something in everything. Like all of a sudden you're driving and you're like, you know, like, you know, you see traffic slow down and you see a guy blow by you real fast and you're like, oh shit, there's going to be an accident. And then the guy mm-hmm. just rear ends a dude. Yeah. So I just got really stuck into this pattern recognition where I was just trying to figure out like what didn't match. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear me say, you know, a bunch of stuff where it's like, you know what, like something just didn't fit. Like this is how normal people, maybe almost, I watched a podcast where this guy was a FBI, CIA, worked for the FBI and the CIA, but he was a profiler mm-hmm. and like a big part of their like profiling and, you know, like different, like people would come through, whether it be customs or this, and they would, you know, have somebody that something was weird. He would come down and like assess them in this. And he was always looking for things outside the ordinary. So I just thought that like that pattern recognition thing just became kind of a superpower.
It really is. It's an extremely valuable skill. I think that's what actually in part made you really good at what you did for so long, is that you were able to cultivate and develop that skill, where I think people usually don't make it to that level or aren't as successful at that stage. Just they're not aware of it, mm-hmm. right? And they kind of just blow it off and never really actually cultivate that skill, which I think is what has helped me so much along my career as well over the past decade of looking at human movement, is to be able to recognize and understand these different patterns that you're seeing, whether or not it's with the shooting athletes that I work primarily with and tactical athletes, or a football player, basketball player, baseball. It doesn't matter. Your brain starts to pick up on those anomalies, those things that aren't in the norm of what we visualize as like beautiful human movement. And it's all engineered within us and our nervous systems from how we evolved, mm-hmm. right? Like we were programmed to look out in nature and look out at our environment and pick up on things that didn't make sense, that just didn't fit. And that was our survival mechanism to understand that, hey, there might be a tiger sitting over there behind that bush.
Do you think everybody does this to some extent, or do you think
it's... I think it's part of the human nature for sure. I just think it's one of those things with the awareness piece again, that some people have the blinders on and we don't ever cultivate that skill. Mm-hmm. So,
well, for you, I mean, you're in a really interesting thing because, you know, obviously you have a clinic and you work mm-hmm. with, you know, CEOs and kind of high net worth, kind of high performers, but then your online persona mm-hmm. is really just working with shooting athletes and high level mm-hmm. shooters, which I think is fascinating for the fact that, you know, you're talking about mastery in terms mm-hmm. of shooting, but you're also talking about managing recoil, which, like to me is like a really fascinating deal. When I first worked with Jeff Gonzalez and the guys at NSW, we figured out pretty quick that there was an efficient human position mm-hmm. to manage recoil the fastest to get more shots on target. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, Power Athlete, we have this blueprint that I've been fucking obsessed about for over a decade of efficient human movement, how mm-hmm. people should set up and how they should move through space. So years ago, I went out to Mid-South, which is a shooting school with the guys from NSW, and their instructors who shoot thousands of rounds a week are by far the most proficient shooters I've ever seen in my life. And what was amazing is they figured out my blueprint for movement off purely trying to manage recoil. Mm-hmm. They knew that like toes forward, knees over the insteps, dropping retracted shoulder blades, pulling the rifle on the pistol into them, maintaining head position, trunk, pulling the top ab down in here, squeezing the glutes, all these positions manage recoil better than toes out and this and laxity. So as I was watching them shoot, I asked them like, and these dudes knew nothing of human performance, knew nothing of anthropometrical ratios or all the other stuff we get jiggy mm-hmm. on. They just know over time that this position allowed them to shoot and manage recoil faster and was more efficient in terms of being able to transition between rifle and pistol mm-hmm. and all the other, you know, mag reloads. I mean, it was really just like seeing it in real time and then realizing that that's a huge part of shooting because
yes.
everybody can get the first shot, but how fast you manage that second shot, you know, for your trap shooting or every, all the mm-hmm. other stuff you guys are doing seems to be the difference between, you know, first and second or first and 100.
Absolutely. Because usually what it comes down to is just one target. Right. And you bring up a good point too about that managing recoil, because that is what leads to the efficiency, right? You're if you have a greater ability to manage that recoil, you can make a second shot that's way more accurate. And when it comes to our shotgun shooters specifically, like you only have two shots, but you have to get both targets under 1.7 seconds with something like Skeet. So you have to make sure everything's pretty much perfect. Mm-hmm. And if the butt of that shotgun is misaligned in the shoulder, it could make all the difference of you being a quarter inch in front of that target and missing it completely.
Mm-hmm.
Or breaking it, which when it comes down to competition, that is the difference between making a final and between meddling and not,
mm-hmm.
which is absolutely fascinating too. And then if you look at the mechanics of it, man, I can go into this for days though, but like, yes, the toes, the leg position, because it all starts down there at the feet and how that they actually turn the hips and be able to manage the lower body. And then when it comes to the upper body, our hands are kind of the same thing, right? So if you look at the grip of the shotgun on the stock, if the grip is off and like the wrist is going into that radial or ulnar deviation, mm-hmm. it impacts what's going on at the shoulder. So what you see is a lot of these stock makers and everything will try and line up the eyes over that bead and try mm-hmm. to make sure that that's the most.
Are all of their guns custom made?
For the most part. Like when you get to the Olympic level, yes, you are customizing your gun as much as you can mm-hmm. at that point. And everybody goes out and gets these custom stocks, these custom grips. And if, like I said, the grip is off and like your hand is kind of only deviating with the pinky pointing down, for example, that will then change what the shoulder does. Because if this goes down, it's going to elevate
sure.
the shoulder, which is then going to lower the butt of the shotgun down from where it actually needs to be to sit in that pocket. But then you look at things like neck pain and shoulder pain. Now we have an obvious reason from a pattern recognition standpoint, once again,
sure.
of, okay, I'm seeing this consistently. You have chronic neck issues. All your massage and your manipulations are kind of temporarily relieving it, but nothing's getting to the root of the problem. Well, that's our issue.
Is it from the percussion? Like the fact that they're managing a recoil and the butt of the gun is hitting them so many times in the shoulder that feels like the driver. I mean, if they're an efficient, if they're lined up and everything is as should and they're managing recoil properly, then probably the neck isn't an issue. But all of a sudden now, if something's lax or something's mm-hmm. in a bad position mm-hmm. and it's magnified.
Absolutely. It's all about stress management at that point, right? Because you could have everything working from the lower body decently well. But if that, like I said, if the butt of that shotgun is off and you're constantly taking recoil with the shoulder in elevation, now we have that levator scap that's in a constantly shortened position. And it's not like it's not bad. I don't want people to think about that. But when it comes to an efficiency or an economical standpoint, when it comes to movement, over time, that's going to become an issue.
Sure.
And the brain and the body are going to then start to revolt. And usually that revolt comes in the signs and symptoms of some type of pain or discomfort.
Do, you know, I mean, obviously a 20 gauge is a lot less of a, you know, mm-hmm. impact than a 12. Mm-hmm. Do these guys shoot both or are they predominantly?
They're all 12 gauge.
They're all 12
at this
gauge.
Level. Yeah, at I mean, level. All of them started at those higher gauges when they were younger.
So we went out to, I got invited to do a charity mm-hmm. kind of skeet deal. And one of my buddies had a 20 and, you know, we all had 12 gauges, but it was pretty interesting. You know, we just showed up. I got a, you know, Benelli you know, just whatever, you know, Cabela's had. Not because I don't shoot skeet very often. I mean, I got more tactical shotguns than that, but I got one. And so I was shooting a 20, and it was hilarious because the old men that showed up there, like, had, I mean, these dudes were like, we walked the course. These guys were showing up in like $75,000 side-by-sides.
Yes.
Like, the guns that these dudes had, these old guys, like, I mean, over-unders, like, I mean, burl walnut engraved. I mean,
the inlays on them, oh, gold, gorgeous.
Yes. Dude, and these guys were absolute killers. Like, these old men, like, lined up.
And that's what I view the sport of shotgun shooting as. It's kind of like golf, right? You can do this sport into your old age and be really, really good at it. Like, you can actually improve into your 50s, 60s, 70s. And we see it all the time. Like, I know you could probably drop like 14 grand on a shotgun, right, John?
I'm not opposed to it if you use it regularly. Right. Like, for me, I shoot skeet like once every 3 years if I get invited to something. Yeah. You know, these guys that we went to, they have a club. These guys all shoot like fairly regularly. Just their rigs. I mean, they pull up these side by sides, the guns. I mean, they, to the point where, like, you can tell they had shot the course so many times that, like, you know, when we walked up, I'd always ask them, like, hey, can you, you know, roll a few? Yeah, see good targets. These guys were just walking up and screaming, pull. And we're like, I was like, you guys have come here before, right? And I mean, it's just what they did. But I was very impressed with not only, I mean, like, there was one dude just didn't miss. And I mean, he wasn't in good physical shape. Old dude, I mean, was just so proficient. You know, but I mean, that's what he does. And, you know, if you put enough time and mastery, I think we have this idea of like athletic performance, but these are also old men shooting at a club in Texas. They're not competing for the Olympics.
And that's totally different too. Cause even if these old guys are shooting to the extent that they are, they're still not putting as many rounds down range as these Olympic shotgun shooting.
So how many rounds does the average shooter shoot in a week? Or, I mean, do they shoot every single day?
Pretty much. But I think everybody's different in their ability to handle the volume of that training. And a lot of that comes down to, are you training in the gym? That makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah. Like, if you're stressing your body in the gym, you're going to have more available to you out there on the training field. You can handle more recoil. Your body's not going to fatigue as easily. You're going to be more efficient. You could do more with less. And that was my whole goal with coming into these teams, is like, well, how can we make you more efficient? How can we make you more economical so that you can train more before either the skill breaks down or your body breaks down?
Was it a hard sell to try to convince them that being strong and in good shape helps everything?
Yes. Well, it's, I mean, I can relate to it though. Because when I played baseball, I grew up in that time period where everybody thought lifting weights was bad for your swing and your mechanics for throwing. And so, like, I understood the mindset, I understood where they were coming from. So it came down to a lot of education and just really helping them feel what the difference is of training. And just getting them to move their bodies differently opened up different areas, different ranges of motion. Now they could use more of it. And that was a really nice entry point into actually resistance training. And like, hey, this isn't bad for you. Like, yes, it may make you sore, but we can manage the soreness. Like, that was the big fear, right? All these decisions come down to fear. Don't want to be sore while they're out of the match, which I totally get. Now, granted, there are some people that actually feel a little bit better shooting sore. And I think there's a great psychological component to that too, because when you're shooting, like, your mind can go in many different directions. And if you're focused inward on your body, it takes your focus off of, like, oh my God, I got to hit this target. So I'm like two targets behind this guy. And like, so you can
quiet
your mind a little bit.
There's a famous deal about never play golf against a guy with a hangover.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a hell of a story about Michael Jordan. I guess they had a game somewhere at night. And this guy actually that he played with, I guess, you know, Jordan and him reached out and they were kind of gambling buddies. And so they go play 18 holes. And, you know, I guess Jordan has like 6 or 8 beers. They get done and, he ended up beating Jordan on the golf course. And so Jordan, like, is pissed off and is like, let's play another 18. And he's like, dude, you got to be there. He's like, we'll be fine. So Jordan drinks more beers. He ends up beating him on the second, you know, so for 36 holes took Jordan. So Jordan tells him, he's like, hey, you know, like, that money, like, I'll bet it to you. Now. Like, you know, I don't know if he bet him on the game. I can't remember exactly if the guy said, but it probably sounds more accurate. And so the guy ends up, like, you know, Jordan leaves and goes, and the guy calls his bookie and he's like, dude, bet the house against the Bulls. You know, Jordan played 16 holes of golf and drank like a dozen beers. There's no way. And he went out and scored like 59 points. They won by like 20. He had like the, you know, one of the, his all time best performances. And, you know, maybe the fact that
it loosens you up.
Yeah.
Right. But mixing the alcohol and gun shooting is probably not a great idea.
Well, that was...
I will say this though, John. There are a couple, and I will not name names, that actually perform better with a hangover.
Yeah.
The next day.
John Runyon, for years, yeah, told me that the best way you play on Sunday is being hungover from Friday. Mm-hmm. So back in the day, guys used to go out and party pretty hard on Saturday night before games. And they ended up instituting the Lawrence Taylor rule, which is now NFL teams all go to a hotel the night before the game and we have meetings. Like, that didn't exist. And that was like the LT rule, because Lawrence, like, there was a story, and Landetta told us a story about, you know, all of a sudden they're getting ready for the game and LT's not there. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the, and then they had to go out and find him, and LT had bought a strip club and moved it next to the Meadowlands so he had a place to go party. So they went to a strip club, yeah, and drug him out of the back, and, yeah, like, you know, like, it's a phenomenal story. Yeah, so that was like the LT rule, was, mm-hmm, like staying the night before the games. But yeah, so the hilarious part is we go to this charity thing to go shoot skeet, and they were really very clear early. If you have a drink, we're taking your wristband. You can't shoot. Mm-hmm. And these old dudes were all like, "Brr!" You know, obviously they go there all the time, you know, but it's a charity thing. Yeah. So I'm sure they're doing what they do. But and they were, you know, we were out there hacking it up. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we don't shoot skeet, and these dudes were like super fired up.
Yeah. So I mean, they get into it.
Yeah.
And it's a really fun culture. It's a fun environment to be around. But even so, just like my baseball experience, that culture never really embraced weight training, never really embraced exercise, because they thought that, once again, didn't want to be sore, but then also you can just, you're out there all day long. You need to focus on the skill of shooting.
Sounds like jujitsu.
It's very, very similar to it. Very, very similar to it. And it's hard for them to wrap their heads around taking some time away from the actual sport specific skill and investing that. And that's the way I see that, investing that into your training inside of a gym, a nice controlled environment. You actually build resiliency and build durability, because it helps with the longevity of your sport.
Sure.
Because there's one athlete who's very decorated, but same thing. She shot one way and her technique is terrible, and essentially put herself into this movement prison box where can't get her arms overhead. Mm. Like, and of course, the older you get, the more things are starting to break down. And so you're seeing a lack of repeatability now, where we've reached this threshold where we've experienced so much stress, so much breakdown, the body just cannot keep up with it anymore. Versus a contemporary of her, somebody within the same generation who is doing a lot of training, and he's my age, he's 34 right now. I think he could shoot into his mid-50s if he really wanted to.
Like, what becomes the limiting factor for these guys? I mean, I like, just because, yeah, you know, you think about like the high level shooting for the Olympics. I mean, I would assume that somebody was probably better in their 30s or 40s or 50s, just because it's not as, mm-hmm, physically demanding. It's not like like one of the gnarliest sports I've ever seen. And I don't know if they still do it in the Winter Olympics, where they have to like do the cross country.
Biathlon?
Yeah. And the shooting. Mm-hmm. Like the level of metabolic demand for those people to be able to do it is really
be able to slow your heart rate down, yeah, too. It's,
yeah, and like so they get timed on the courses, and then they have to like recover and shoot. And there was I watched something about it where, like, you know, there's like a perfect age, because the VO2 max obviously, sure, at a certain age starts dropping off, and they need this highly tuned aerobic, mm-hmm, system to be able to recover in this. And then there was like one dude who was just so efficient in his shooting and his skiing that he was able to do it way past everybody else. So with the shooting, you know, I wouldn't think that like physical age would be a limiting factor, but maybe it is with reflexes.
Well, the thing is, the eyes start to go. That's where you see a lot of the breakdown with the age component of it anyway. But it's just like any other sport, where the number one reason why we see athletes stop their sport or retire altogether is pain and injury. Yeah. And that holds true even with these shooting athletes.
Same with me.
It starts breaking their body down enough to where they're like, fuck it, we're done with this.
I have a interesting theory.
Okay.
And this is purely just from, you know, obviously retiring and, you know, all the stuff we do with our training, but even like what we've been doing with Jits, I'm pretty convinced that one of the main factors for avoiding injury, at least for me, is making sure that I have a well-developed aerobic system. Mm-hmm. I gave no credence and zero fucks to doing any form of aerobic work when I played in the NFL. I had this theory that if I wasn't lifting heavy and running as fast as I can, that I felt that you developed your aerobic system as a byproduct of like intense ATP glycolytic mm-hmm. training. Like you go hard, that shit works. I like thought it was complete horse shit. Zone one, zone two, did nothing. It was basically what, you know, fucking people at the gym who were lazy did. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we did 22 Jack Street, we did the challenge. And all of a sudden I had to like cut into a body weight. And the only way, you know, and I remember I was doing the anabolic, I wasn't losing weight. I was getting stronger. Everything was like going in the right direction, but I had to hit a weight goal. Mm-hmm. And so I hit up Morrow, and Morrow was like, either got to cut calories or you got to up your energy expenditure or you got to do both. So I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, you're going to have to do like zone one, zone two, and like monitor the calories and really just dial it in. And I was like, oh, fuck, I've like shit on this for years. And, but my weight wasn't moving. So I've been a big fan of like, I hate pulling calories. I would rather just do more work. So we started doing like 45, 50, 60 minutes of just like zone one, zone two, 120, 125 beats right in there. And then on the way home, I would stop at this place called the, I think it was called like the Heat Lounge or something. And they had mm-hmm. infrared saunas. So I would immediately go right in and do like 20 or 30 minutes in the infrared sauna. And then I'd go home. And then at night I was doing more and more work. And then I got to the point where I had to cut calories and ended up, yeah. So I was actually in caloric restriction, high protein, you know, obviously high protein diet. I was hitting, you know, we were trained at 6 a.m, banging a bunch of heavy weights. And then I was doing the aerobic work and then obviously that sauna. And all of a sudden we were doing like max rep kind of 5-3-1 Windler S sets, mm-hmm. like, you know, hey, we're going to hit this. And then, you know, in Power Athlete, we hit rep maxes and I strip it off and do max rep sets. What we were doing is I was kind of pyramiding up and we were testing kind of like this one set to failure, mm-hmm. kind of similar to what we're doing right now with Matt's program. And I started PRing every lift. I pulled like 585 for like a set of eight. Which I'd never pulled. It's like close to 600 for eight reps off the ground. I PR'd my bench. I PR'd my squat. I was PRing everything on these rep maxes. And I was like, dude, I'm the hungriest I've ever been. I've never been doing this much work. And, all of a sudden my heart rate variability I was monitoring was like, I couldn't get out of the green. Mm-hmm. I'd wake up every morning in green, which I shouldn't have, with the amount of stress. And the only thing I could point to was this really, I mean, 6 days a week, 7 days a week of doing this aerobic work. And then even, you know, and then with challenge ends and mm-hmm. it's a pain in the ass to do. So then as I started basically doing jiu-jitsu again, I was feeling kind of sore and like not really recovering. So we started pushing the aerobic stuff, just because on Matt's program, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, you know, we do a full body kind of max effort, kind of like rep deal. And then it's like jits and aerobic work and, you know, just started doing it. And all of a sudden, like I wasn't getting sore from jits anymore. And all of a sudden my performance was going up and I was like, wait a minute. And I honestly really think that, like, you know, especially with, you know, Victor and the guys that we were training, once we started really pushing the zone two, and I was like, hey, you guys are going to come in. You guys are obviously rolling this, but I need you to work on this piece, because we started wearing heart rate monitors at practice. Mm-hmm. And there was never a point where we were in that zone one, two, you know, it was like you were either peaking. And, you know, I mean, it'd be much different with Shanji or some of like the really mm-hmm. high level dudes. Like, I bet you Shanji's heart rate never gets over 100. He's so efficient,
yeah.
But like, you know, you're in a competition where some dude's literally trying to fucking take your head off. Like, just the stress of that has your heart rate up. So, like whenever I talk to any of the guys at practice about training, I always ask them like, what are you doing outside of here? And they're going to jiu-jitsu for their fitness.
Yeah. We heard that last night.
We heard it last night. Times. Yeah. And it's like, this isn't your fitness. This is a test for your fitness. You have to cultivate your fitness in another way. You know, whether it be like zone two, you got to lift some weights, you got to do this, so that the sum of those parts allow you to be successful here. Mm-hmm. If you're coming for this, we're not going to be able to do it.
No, you can't. And what you're referring to is your just ability to utilize oxygen more, right? The beautiful molecule, because it helps break down into ATP, which you use for energy, and saturate the muscles more. So it makes sense that you were able to PR and feel really good. And
I look back and I made a huge fucking tactical error during my playing days, that I really think that if I had put more effort into the zone one, zone two stuff, I think the recovery would have been mm-hmm. better. I've always said that sleep is like my superpower, mm-hmm. that like I can go to bed, you know, sore, fucked up, injured, with pain, whatever. And if I go to sleep, I'll always wake up without pain, without injury. Like, it's literally like it's a reset for me. Mm-hmm. So I also figured out, you know, that the zone 1-2 stuff helps with the sleep. And then the other big thing too is I've been taping my mouth. I'm not kidding you. I went to bed last night when we get home, like 9:30, 10 o'clock. Yeah. So I was in bed by like 10:15, 10:30. And I slept till like 5 a.m. And I like wake up, take the mouth tape off. And I'm like ready to start my day.
Whereas, you're such a mouth breather, John.
I don't know if I was that big a mouth breather, but I just think it's an easier form of oxygen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it humidifies through the nose and you're able to.
But think about it. Like if you're laying there, I mean, I could take in more oxygen through my mouth than my nose, right? So if I'm like, you know, but it's also accessing that sympathetic, the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight. I always thought that was reversed, but I don't know why. But I would recommend, especially for professional athletes and anybody that gets paid to do what they do, having a highly tuned aerobic system is actually going to help everything else. And, you know, I only did it because, you know, we're doing some bodybuilding deal and I needed to like, you know, lean out and try to like win our contest. And the byproduct of it taught me more. And then if you go read like Joel Jameson stuff or anybody that's like really into that conditioning piece, that a really efficient, well-developed, well-balanced, nice big aerobic base, which helps with mitochondrial density. Yeah. It's fucking like a superpower.
Well, I had a big lesson in that last night, didn't I?
Yeah. Right when
you and I finally go at the end for the last round, and I had a probably good, I don't know, 3 minutes left in me.
And you shot gassed. All six bullets.
Yes, the whole load.
Gone. Oh my God, dude. You like Tasmanian devil. Like we hit this and you were going 100 miles an hour. And I just like, I had you in full guard. That's where we were starting. And so I broke your posture and you were fucking fighting me. And I just kept breaking your posture. And then you actually got me into pretty good side control. Yeah. And then I was able to like basically get back into my shield, get my knee up, slip it back around and get you back into position. And then all of a sudden you went, and the fucking energy went from 100 to zero, swept you. And you were like, oh, that's it.
You saw that dial, like where it goes from like red,
dude,
like green to red real quick. Like I could feel it go.
Dude, it was like your superpowers just sort of like, you were like, duh, duh, duh. And I was like, holy shit, dude, like Matt's super strong. He's like, this is a fucking roll. And then I actually didn't know you were going to guess.
Yeah.
And then when you did, I was like, oh, dude, this is great.
I felt it coming. Like I felt really good though, cause I was able to sprawl on you a bit and like, cause I got super mobile hips.
Yeah.
And
well, we both do. Yeah. I mean, that's one superpower. We're like strippers.
Yeah. But then when I got on top of you in the side control and like you got your hands up in the brace position there.
Yeah. It's called the, what do I call it? Shields or,
frames. Yeah. Yes. My brain was blanking just like when I got gassed and I could stop thinking. I was actually really proud of myself because one of my metrics of success in that sport anyway is my ability to connect the dots, like to feel the pressure and my body just kind of knows what to do. And I felt moments of that last night as well. But then I got into that side control and like you got those frames in and I'm like trying to dig my chin into you and break your arms. I'm like, this is why he bench presses so much.
Yeah, no, guy. I'm like, really no strong in this position, especially with my elbows. I'm like, you're not going to break my frames.
Happen. It wasn't going
to
happen.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, dude. I was really, I was stoked that one, we got to roll and two, that you had fun. And I think the class of dudes, so it's rare, like I've only rolled, and I know you're gonna laugh at this, I've only rolled with like one other white belt. Yeah. So at our class, there's always like my buddy Don, who's a purple belt, and then a bunch of Big Pedro and all these guys always come to the class, and then they always like, you know, hey, okay, great, a partner, and they'll be like, touch me. And I'm like, all right. So I roll with like purple, but there's some pretty good blue belts too. Mm-hmm. This guy Josh is pretty good. So I always have really good training partners. And so it's rare that I actually get to scrap against somebody who's kind of like been doing it maybe, about the same time as I have.
Yeah.
So, I mean, which I think is hilarious. It was great, dude. Yeah. I loved it.
I mean, same with me too, because my training partner back in Phoenix is
fucking killer.
A former high-level wrestler as well. So, and also guys. 40 pounds heavier than me.
Yeah.
And so I'm used to handling going with that amount of weight and that amount of size. But yeah, it's just like the cardio got me there at the end.
It was fun. Well, you had an interesting, very similar experience to me, which kind of like, I hate jiu-jitsu. Like I just do. Like the thought of being on my back with somebody on top of me, and I've made this joke before, like it's become much more natural. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they say the things like embrace the things that you dislike, embrace discomfort, and, you know, Jocko and, David Goggins and, you know, fuck the, you know, and there's this kind of constant deal. But, you know, you don't get better doing the things that you love to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, everybody loves to do the things, but like you got to embrace shit you don't like.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we had a kind of a similar experience in that we had Craig Douglas on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Craig comes and he's a, you know, ShipWorks, like just like a legendary, you know, kind of combatives, shooting knife, just like not necessarily like, you know, Jeff Gonzalez is an amazing shooting instructor. Mm-hmm. And so is Craig, but like Craig teaches like a holistic deal. It's fighting, it's catch wrestling, it's battling, it's guns, it's knives. It's like this whole combatives thing. Whereas Jeff's just super, you know, not just super, but like incredibly like a master of teaching the pistol. Yep. Craig's kind of like the whole kind of shebang, right? So I go to his course, or he says to me on the podcast, hey, you should come to one of our courses. And I'm like, great, love to. So 2 days before, like this is like months later, he calls me. He's like, hey, we're having a course in Austin. Love if you can come up. And I was like, fuck. All right. Well, I said I'd go. And like, if I say I'm going to go, I'm going to go. So he's like, what do I need? 200 rounds of gun and a cup and a mouthpiece. And I'm like, oh shit.
Cup and a mouthpiece. That's,
I said,
that's not what we want to see.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, when is it? He's like, it starts Friday night and it's Saturday and Sunday. And like, you know, having taught seminars, I'm like, how many hours are we talking? And he's like, we're shooting for like close to 30. And I'm like, 30 hours?
200 rounds.
I was like, 200 rounds. I'm like, what? Like I didn't know. And I had never really researched any of his stuff. I mean, I know what he had talked about, but I just wasn't clued in on ShipWorks. Mm-hmm. And we show up and, excuse me. And, you know, the first night was all about like just assessing danger, mm-hmm. right? Which is pretty much shit I picked up working security at a bar. Like who's going to be the troublemaker, how to position yourself, and just kind of like just this kind of, you know, he was an undercover cop kind of profiling piece. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. I mean, this is all shit I picked up as a bouncer. Like mm-hmm. I appreciate this stuff. And like one of the classic ones is like, you know, like the way people sucker punch people, like what they do is they kind of like touch their like face or their hair, or like bring their head back to try to get their arm up. And so like, if you're ever in a situation stressful and you see somebody like start touching their face, you know, they're going to throw a punch. And dude, I saw that a million times. All of a sudden guys would get into it and a guy would like kind of put his hand up and try to sneak somebody. And like just shit like that was incredible. So then the next day we show up at 8 a.m. and it's like, it's on to the point where we had an hour lunch and it got dark and we ended up pulling trucks or cars around like high school fight style. He had helmets, sim guns, like it was a free for all. And the dude that they paired me up with is Nick from Starting Strength. Nick used to be like 350 mm-hmm. pounds. He's like 6'1". Now he's probably like 300, 330, maybe 325. At the time, he was a purple belt. I think he's a brown belt now. And they put me flat on my back. They put him in side control. And I have a gun in one hand. He has a gun in one hand. And our other hand is on the guns. So like, I'm here. He's got his hand here and I got here and I'm on my back. He fucking passes my guard like that. Like I didn't know about getting my knees up, getting on my side, nothing. Mm-hmm. I'm like trying to push him off, which is terrible because that's how you end up in arm bars, but we have guns. He pretty much passes my guard, pins my arm at my side, takes, like I grabbed his gun and I threw it out of his hand. He like pins my arm, takes my gun and shot me here at close range with the Sims. And I still have the scars. He killed me quickly. And every time I was on my back, I was like a turtle. Like I had zero ability to fight off my back. And, but on my feet, I was like, I'm great on my feet. Like I can one-on-one fight. Like if we're on our feet, like all that stuff, like I was fine to just smashing people. Mm-hmm. Scotty, who is one of Craig's instructors, a former NSW guy, black belt in jits, he's like, dude, you got to learn some ground game. You got to learn some jits. And I was like, ugh. So he ends up introducing me to Shanji, who is his coach. And that's how I met Shanji, was through Scott, mm-hmm. because I got fucking murdered at this event. And I hate losing more than I actually hate being on my back in jiu-jitsu. So I knew embracing it was good. And then that's how I ended up getting up there. But you had a similar experience.
Very, very similar. We're very much alike in
we have to be shamed into stuff.
Shame and judgment and guilt. Yeah. Cause it was about January of last year. Yeah. I came out here and I took Tim Kennedy's sheepdog course. And
you were so excited.
So excited. So pumped. I really had no idea what I was getting into though. Yeah. Really,
you're like, hey, I train these shooters. I'm going to go to the shooting course.
Yeah, I was all in it for the pistol stuff. That was great. And then from zero jiu-jitsu experience to 8 hours in 2 days.
Yeah.
Crushed my soul. But yeah, very, very similar experience.
And didn't you roll with Tim?
And well, that's where this goes. downhill real quick because I ended up, so I wrestled a little bit in college, or sorry, in high school. And this one guy came at me, you know how it is in these courses, like nobody has any experience. He's just trying to go after my head, but had fists out. So I took one across the face. And you remember I came in, I had my nose broken open, had a black eye.
Yeah.
And that pissed me off. And one of the rules that Tim gave was like, no throws.
Yeah.
But I baited him in for a leg. And what I used to do is in high school is I would cement mixer them. Mm-hmm. And so I'd toss him over my shoulder. And so I did that to the guy and it kind of jacked up his neck. Felt really great though, because I tapped him afterwards and I fixed his neck afterwards as well because I felt terrible. But Tim saw the whole thing. And like you just have to picture this, right? Because I got the nice man bun up right now. Sure. But like the hair was down. I'm sweating. I'm exhausted at this point. It's like at the very end of our like 90 minutes of round robin rolling for five minute rounds. And I'm just like trying to like walk myself off to the side at this point. And Tim comes over and he's like, hey man, saw what you did there. Takes my hand like a little baby, like a child. He's like, come with me. Walks me over to the corner of the room. Ioko was the other guy. I think that's how you say his name. And he hit the bell. And of course, Tim just proceeded to whoop my ass for 5 minutes and like got me down on my stomach. Like I was just tunnel vision going black. I was trying to tap him and takes my hand and he pushes it down the mat and leans his mouth into my ear and was like, this isn't a tap. You're just uncomfortable. Keep going. And the same moment too, dude, I was like, well, I never want that to happen again. Yeah. So I want to come back and do it again with some level of jiu-jitsu experience and actually be able to hold my own and like actually fight back to a good extent.
Yeah. So. We know your health and wellness are a priority. That's why we partnered with Stay Classy Meats. They are dedicated to connecting you with the finest responsibly raised meats on the planet. Their direct partnerships with farmers and ranchers mean they can deliver to you nationwide. They're more than a meat company. They're a network of athletes and farmers committed to superior nutrition. Stay Classy works with producers like R.C. Carter, whose regenerative agricultural practices result in beef that's packed with 75% more essential amino acids, phytonutrients, and a perfect blend of omega-3-6 ratio. Experience the difference with their 10-pound ground beef or 15-pound assorted meat subscription box, specially branded as the Stay Classy Power Athlete box. Click on the link and order today with the promo code POWERATHLETE, all one word. Join us in securing your health and food supply chain. Stay Classy Meats, superior nutrition, naturally. It's time to step up your game. Stay classy with us.
Well, we, you know, Tim teaches a wrestling class for all the comp guys at Six Blades, which has been a pretty good deal for them. So I actually dragged Matt Pollock up there because, you know, Matt still he coaches wrestling at 3F. And, you know, obviously Division I wrestler and still pretty proficient. And so we went up there and it was awesome. He literally goes out like Superman, zero cardio, is like picked up a dude, suplexed him, was just fucking dudes up. And it was great. Like just dude walks in off the street, like 38-year-old dad just happened to be a Division I wrestler. I'm like, this is great.
Walked through the wrong doors that day.
No, it's been really good. I think that they're you know, John Danaher, who's, you know, kind of a local jiu-jitsu legend, or not a local, but international. And he's here in Austin and, you know, he's Gordon Ryan's coach. So, you know, he's really embraced, you know, wrestling and, you know, Lex Friedman's had, you know, Tom Brand and Terry Brand, like the, you know, who are the coaches at Iowa and Dan Gable. And, I wasn't necessarily a big student of wrestling. I didn't wrestle in high school, like we've talked about, but, through, you know, Matt, you know, obviously it's a big deal for him. He'll text and send me stuff. And so I've been kind of more indoctrinated into this. And there's a interesting piece, I think, for jiu-jitsu. You know, like the guys in the no-gi have really embraced, because it is really wrestling in a lot of ways. It's like submission wrestling. And, you know, now trying to take that back into the gi and kind of do this mentality where I think that there's at least in the gi coming from Brazil, there's it's very, I don't know, like I'm not saying passive in any way, but it's a little more relaxed. Sure. Where now all of a sudden from like the wrestling input and what you're seeing is, you know, and like, you know, Shanji's a great example. Like those dudes are absolutely trying to be killers out there. Mm-hmm. They're trying to go out there and stamp motherfuckers' names on their foreheads. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's been a really interesting influence from like the, you know, the Iowa wrestler that mentality of like, I'm going to die out here before I lose, and kind of taking that and like bleeding that into jiu-jitsu with like the movement and the technique and all that. It's, I think it's a really beautiful marriage.
Yeah. And I think it's a really great movement practice as well, from a learning standpoint, and helping develop those different new neurological connections that
neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity, right? So, I mean, that's one of the things that helps stave off a lot of Alzheimer's and dementia in our later years, is learning something new, a new skill. And yeah, you know, working your mind with puzzles and stuff like that. Yeah. But also, movement is a big puzzle. You have to solve, like, you can watch somebody move.
It's called athletic problem solving.
Athletic problem solving. Figure out how to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
Which really is your mobility, right? And we saw that a little bit with your shoulder, because you had a shoulder surgery a couple of years ago now, right? And you were mentioning last night how you're seeing a lot of improvements in it, and a lot of it coming from the jiu-jitsu, because you're placing it into these different end ranges of motion that it hasn't been in before, and has to work there. And then the brain's like, well, shit, if he's gonna be working here, we might as well make this strong and open it up for him.
As banged up, you know, I got these osteophytes and bone chips in my knee, and so I'm limited on some things. But what's wild is that, you know, water finds its level, or you'll figure, like, I've just developed incredible hip mobility to the point where, you know, even as we're doing stuff, and I know Shanji's real conscious of it, and I know he's great in that he's always teaching me modifications. He's like, hey, dude, like, if you're, you know, like, you're lacking mobility on this knee, you need to do it this way. And he, like, you saw him come over, and he's always giving me little changes, which is incredible. But at some point, I'll just go and get this stuff removed. But there's people that have not nearly as bad a knee that can't do any of this stuff because they haven't cultivated some of the other stuff. Like when you worked on me and you're like, I can't believe your knee bends this poorly, but you can hide it because of the hip mobility.
Yeah. Very similar to me from being a catcher for so many years. My ankle mobility was dog shit, but my body found the way around it by opening up my hips more.
Well, and the other one too is, I was super impressed with how much work you've done on your feet. You know, we were talking about like the three things most people come for T4 is going to be neck, shoulder, and back. But I think really what's been fascinating, and I know where we connected, was really on the foot. Like, absolutely. I've been fat, and I know I'm not a foot fetish person, but I'm
that's my OnlyFans page. Can't have it.
Okay. Well,
you could be a guest on it. Like, I'm a guest on your podcast.
This is hilarious. But my daughter, Jamie,
weird transition.
It was a super weird transition. So I read a fascinating piece of research that for like the last like 50 to 70 years, somebody's collected. I don't know how they collect this data. So don't ask me, because I didn't deep dive into the data collection. But they ask kids at about age anywhere from like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, what do you want to be when you grow up? And for the last 60 some years, it's been about service or adventure. So you're either service or adventure. I want to be an astronaut because I want to go to space. I want to be a fireman because I want to help people. I want to be a nurse because my grandma got sick. I want to be an archaeologist. I want to do this. So it's always about service and adventure. And it's been like this forever. Like, little kids grow up with this idea that I want to be a superhero. I want to save people. I want to help people. And I want to travel to different places. I want to be an archaeologist. I want to be an explorer. So it's always been about service and adventure. And then a couple of years ago, maybe within the last 10 years, it's completely pivoted. Now it's like, I just want to be rich. Because there's this idea that if you have money, then you get to like travel solves your problems. Yeah. And so whereas kids before were about service and adventure, now it's like, I just want to be rich. So I asked Jamie, I was like, you know, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And we were talking about it. And she told me that one of the girls in her class wants to sell pictures of her feet because she saw on like some website that the girl makes like $1 million a month selling pictures of her feet. And she's like, do you think that people could sell pictures of their feet? Like she was like kind of fascinated or just like, why would people buy pictures of people's feet? And why would they make that much money? How would they make $12 million a year off pictures of their feet? And I'm like, Jamie, they're not selling just feet pictures. No. There's other weird stuff that they're doing. It's like pornography. And I went through the whole thing. And, that was a pretty fascinating deal with like the foot. And I'm just trying to make a funny joke about the OnlyFans that you have for your feet. But I know your feet were pretty jacked.
Yes.
From, you know, not only grew up wearing boots, but you grew up cleats in Pennsylvania for life. Cleats. Yeah. And if you look at cleats, they're like literally pointed. Like I had, when I played football in the NFL, this was a little different than college because we didn't have as many shoe options. So the typical cleats are going to like come to a point. And they didn't necessarily make wide sizes. So I was stuck in these cleats and my feet hurt constantly. When I got to the NFL, the first thing I asked when I got a Nike deal is, do you sell wides and do you have a shoe with a wide toe box? So I ended up with these mold cleats that had a really wide kind of square toe box. They weren't cool looking. They weren't like the best shoes to run in, but like I could actually splay my toes and wiggle my toes. And it was like freedom. And the way I ended up getting to it was, I think it was my junior or senior year. We were playing up in Wazoo and they had really shitty turf. And as I was blocking a guy, I was like rolling forward on my toe and the running back landed on the back of my foot. And I ended up with a mild Lisfranc. So they x-rayed it and they're like, you know, it's not completely detached Lisfranc, it's a partial. So what they did is they just basically injected Novocaine and lidocaine before every practice and every game into the top of my foot. It's and they just numbed it. And then I went out and played. Yeah, so they would inject it, and then they kind of did this like tape to kind of wrap job. And I I played on that. The only problem was because my foot was numb, I ended up having to open my foot and push off the inside of my foot because I couldn't feel the top of my foot. So I ended up playing off my instep, which ended up being the catalyst for all of the toes forward that you hear from, you know, from Power Athlete and we've been teaching, because all of a sudden I had always kind of played in this position. Now all of a sudden I was having to open my foot and press off my instep, which wasn't numb, because there's a weird thing where if you can't feel your foot, when I get down to press, I don't know if I'm pressing off. Like you need to feel, like I needed to feel that tactical feedback, but the top of my foot was completely numb. And then most of my foot was kind of numb. So like, even like my toes were kind of numb. So when I pushed off the top of my foot, I couldn't feel the push off. So I ended up turning to the side and pushing off of my heel and my instep.
That's a very intuitive experience for you too.
Yeah. Because it was super weird, but the thing was,
you figured it out.
Oh, I wasn't nearly as fast or dynamic, and I couldn't absorb, generate, and reload and change direction and force with it. So when all of a sudden my foot started, got better, and I realized that this was a shitty position for me, and I went back to toes forward, knee over the instep, driving off my big toe and using my arch. But then also I did so much stuff to rehab my feet, you know, like picking up jacks and the bands and all the other stuff that we've developed for your, like through your foot course, but just assessing foot weakness. And then what was wild is when they x-rayed my foot years later, they were like, hey, you know, you had a mild Lisfranc, you should have had this fixed. I was like, yeah, they didn't tell me that and they're fine, but it's like, it's scarred over. But because your feet have stayed so mobile and strong, it's not much of an issue. So,
well, that's why the foot course that I built is built into essentially two different categories. One, the sensory side of things, and then two, the mechanical side of things. Because what you just brought up are the mechanical issues with having to turn the foot out and not being able to maintain what I call a tripod foot. So your big toe knuckle, the fifth toe knuckle, and that inside portion of your heel, that big toe and fifth toe knuckle are your transverse arch. And it acts like a wheelbarrow. It's like a class two lever in physics. It's designed to handle a lot of heavy load. So your big heavy ass in cleats on the football field, when you plant like that and the heel comes up, it uses it as a pivot point and a lever. And so that arch needs to be strong. And if you don't have that other point of contact, it's all going to, like you said, go through that big toe knuckle and you're going to be in a poor position. You don't have any strength and power there. Right. Same thing with balance. If you lose one of those legs of a tripod, what happens? You're going to fall over.
Well, shit. Right? I mean, so, you know, they like you can't walk
an ACL. From your,
well, you can't walk if you don't have a big toe.
Right.
And I saw a pretty cool piece of it was a study where people lost their big toes and then they couldn't walk, but then they gave them artificial big toes, which was like a fake toe that they just strapped to their foot. It wasn't even connected to their body, but because the arch absorbed the load and they had something to balance off of, they could walk with that fake big toe.
And the brain could figure it out then.
Yeah.
It's the same thing like what we're doing with, I think this is coming out of Baylor now where that research is at, but they're taking amputees, like tactical amputees, and they're giving them VR glasses. And they're, if they have an amputation, they can give them the VR glasses that makes their brain look like they have an actual foot and leg, and it teaches them how to walk again. Oh, the same reason that prosthetic, that toe that you just described, allowed the brain to, oh, there's a toe here. We can actually use this. And it'll relearn that pattern because of that sensory stimulation. Because our feet and our hands, for that matter, unlike if they're any other part of our body, they have the highest amount of proprioceptors, mechanoreceptors found anywhere else. It's a very unique kind of skin called glabrous skin, which is actually means to grasp because it has haptic receptors in there. And so similarly with the foot, when it's numb because you get an injection that you couldn't feel anything either. Mm-hmm. And so the brain was like, well, shit, we're not getting any nutritious information fed upwards to us. So we really don't know how to move our body very, very well.
Yeah.
But think about that. Like that's a very, I would say an extreme example, right? Because in an athletic population, you don't really get numb feet all that often.
Yeah, no,
but
it was a terrible feeling.
Think about like diabetics who get diabetic neuropathy and their foot goes numb. That's why they have such poor balance and they can't walk. But then also just a general everyday athletic population that are like working out in their gyms or playing rec sports. If you're in shoes all day long, your foot's never getting stimulated by anything other than the actual cushion of the shoe. And you know, with me growing up, you brought up the cleats, but I was also in the big, the big heavy Brooks shoes, mm-hmm. right? I was wearing, because I was back with Pennsylvania, I was wearing steel toe Carolina boots to high school in camo because that was a cool thing to do.
Sure.
And then in cleats the rest of the afternoon for practice. And so my foot never really learned how to be a foot, never learned how to experience any other stimulation. And so all those neural networks just essentially degraded, went away. And then the muscles in the foot actually atrophied. Like it's really cool. If you take somebody's shoes off and you look at their feet, I could tell you right now if they have healthy feet or not. Just by looking at them.
Yeah.
Because like if you and I have very vascular veiny feet.
Yeah.
And that means there's a lot of blood flow going through there because you're actually using the foot appropriately. People take their shoes off and sometimes they'll just see like skin. Like you can't even see the bones or the veins going out throughout the foot. And I'm like, oh, we got a lot of work to do here.
When we were kids, this still trips me out. I would wear my shoes in the house and I would wear them into my room and I would take them off. You know, obviously, and then like, you know, whatever, like, but I would, when I would get dressed in the morning, I would like get dressed, put my shoes on and then walk out. Like we don't wear shoes in our house. Mm-mm. I like, you know, there was a study that came out of Japan where they found that like not wearing shoes in the house reduces illnesses by like 80%. Yeah. And like the fact that you're tracking shit around. Yeah. And then here in Texas, like there's dirt and shit everywhere. Like I couldn't imagine like to the point where people come to my house and like they'll come in with shoes and I kind of am like, dude, seriously, take your shoes off. Like, you know, like just like you wouldn't wear your shoes in the dojo. When we went to Japan, I love the fact that everybody had like a little like shoe caddy and you would like put them in and people would either wear socks or they had like little flip flops or little like kind of things to put on and they just don't wear shoes in the house. And I was like, dude, that is the best thing. So like, you know, when I lived in Jersey or when I moved to Philly, obviously it was wet, cold outside. I just left my shoes outside, went barefoot. Mm-hmm. And then when I bought a house, I just like, you know, I had like a wet room. Like you like came in the laundry room, you took all your shoes off and just walked around barefoot. And, you know, and then when I remember when I went to stay with my buddy Drake Parker's family in Hawaii, that was their deal. Like it was kind of like Japanese in that, you know, you wear flip flops and you take your flip flops and you just go barefoot. Mm-hmm. And I just was amazed at, you know, and then like this also coincides. We had a guy, Lee Cohen, who was our podiatrist at the Eagles. And I remember he looked at my feet day one and it's like, dude, I can either make you orthotics today. Or if you make me a deal that I'll, that you basically don't ever wear shoes, you know, take care of your feet. And he kind of showed me this hair, this whole care product deal. And I was like, all right, we're in. Showed me how to stretch my feet, how to take care of my feet. And it was like, the only time I want you to wear shoes is when you're on the football field. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I need you going barefoot. I need you constantly working on your toes and making sure that you're, you know, working through your arches. And if you do that, you'll never have any foot issues. And then I asked him, well, why do you make orthotics? And he's like, well, that's how we make money.
Money, yes, absolutely.
Right? And people are lazy and they won't do this. And then he also made a joke. I guess his dad was a podiatrist. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what do you think we did before people, we could make orthotics? Mm-hmm. He's like, we had to teach people how to care for their feet.
Yes.
And so let me show you a little bit of that. He was great. He, I think about him every time I like go to stretch my feet and I'm like, man, Doc Cohen was the man.
Well, I remember back when I was in grad school at Duke, we go on these different rotations. Right. For like clinical rotations. And one of them was actually in Atlanta. And my mentor there was an older guy. And I witnessed over the 3 months that I was there, he was making a lot of money off these custom orthotics, right? Where he was doing it the old school way and taking the plaster of Paris and wrapping it around these people's feet and making a molded position.
Oh shit.
And I'm like, none of this makes any sense because, like, one, you're doing it in an offloaded position too, so the foot hanging off the table. Like, now it's not even like touching the ground.
So they weren't like putting like plastic Paris and then standing in, so there was weighted.
No, it was hanging off the edge of a treatment table.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'll never forget. And this is kind of where I was like, all right, I'm over this bullshit. There was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu athlete that came in, and mind you, this is like 2011-12 time frame. And had a lot of foot issues. And this, I swear to God, this guy tried to sell him on orthotics, and I'm like, You realize he's barefoot like 90% of the day, right?
Yeah.
Like, what are these orthotics going to do for him? And that's kind of where I started thinking, like, logically, like asking the deeper questions, like, hey, now this makes sense. Like, we need to figure out a better way to do this.
So one of the things, you know, Louis Simmons, God rest his soul. I doubt he's up in heaven. He's probably down. Look, he's probably looking up at us or somewhere in between. But Louis had was such a like a treasure trove of knowledge. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that Tom and those guys went back and did all these podcasts. And there's just so much information. Yeah. And we had the honor of doing the last one with him before he passed. But he made an interesting point to me where he's like, if somebody walks with their foot duck footed, it means they have weak glutes. Mm-hmm. And he's like, toes forward, big step in, the glutes. And he was, even though he has, you know, Chuck Vogelpohl and these guys have been world record squatters, their toes out. Louis was a big proponent of athletes or go toes forward. And he made an interesting point about that. Like, if the toes always turn out, it's usually weak glutes. And that's one of the things you look for within your pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. So with Jits, I don't know if you noticed last night, like those dudes that showed up from Australia were all toes out, kind of like weak glute, you know, duck foot. We call it jujitsu feet, mm-hmm. where they kind of just like walk like this. And I know when we started working with Victor and Arash and Philippe, big thing for those guys is, you know, I know you guys are constantly in this like pulling guard. There's kind of toes out, but I was like, you don't need to reinforce this pattern here because if we don't get into this toes forward, so really getting those guys into a toes forward model and really working on their glutes and their strength. Yeah. And then for them to be like, I'm so much more explosive. So actually being able to take something that's kind of just been a default for some of these guys for so many years and then fixing their mobility or their just foot position. And then also, you know, toes straight ahead, big toe, driving the knee out, creating arches. Constantly forcing them into this arch position.
Well, careful, you're letting the cat out of the bag of like the secret to all my program stuff because
this is the foundation for power athlete. That's why we all developed this stuff in
It's pattern recognition, right? Like all I'm doing and I'm watching somebody move is from an awareness standpoint, seeing what they're really good at doing already, like how their nervous system is built and where their resting positions are and how they move their body throughout space. How has their brain figured out the most efficient way right now to move their body through space? And from there, we can understand how they're actually stressing the body and which tissues are being loaded more than others. And then this isn't rocket science, John. You just give them stuff that they're not good at doing, right? Yeah. Stuff that's gonna help them build more robustness and bandwidth and more movement literacy. That's the game plan. That's like what the whole foot course thing is. It starts off with awareness. Like I have you close your eyes and you bring awareness down to your feet and figure out where the pressures are. Because that's going to give you an idea of actually where, how you're moving your body and where you're placing the load. So that tells me how it's impacting the hips. It tells me how it's impacting the low back. And, you know, we brought up the three most common things with, you know, the foot and the ankle and the low back and the shoulder. Well, you cannot correct what's going on at the shoulder or low back without correcting what's going on at the feet first. Mm-hmm. Because it's the feet forward, it's the feet up. Yeah. Mechanism where it's affecting everything else up the rest of the kinetic chain. Same thing with my shooting athletes and why I've been able to be so successful with them. It's because it's like they're standing in one place, John. Like they're not moving when they're shooting the gun. So all their movement, all the rotation that they need to move the gun left to right to go after these skeet targets or these hard left and rights and trap for the shotgun shooters has to come from the feet. Like I need to be able to see one foot pronate, the other foot supinate to be able to turn the hips left. Like right versus left, or in the opposite to go the opposite direction. If you're not getting that, I know you're not moving efficiently at the hip and the pelvis, which means that you're likely gonna have to excessively compensate through the trunk, mm-hmm. and that changes gun angle and orientation, right? So it's one of those things where I could figure that stuff out as far as like, well, your shoulder and your neck hurts because you're not actually using your right foot effectively, or you're placing too much weight on the left foot. But then also, if you're missing a consistent target, like on a specific station, we can watch that and figure out from an efficiency of movement standpoint why it's happening versus because like most shooting coaches look at, we call it the beat out, mm-hmm. right? They're looking at the target and they're figuring out, okay, well, where did the wad go? Where did the pattern of the BBs go? And they could tell them if they're like forward, in front of it, behind it, up, down, like nowhere near it, whatever, which is, it's useful. And you absolutely need that because it helps with the hold points and the break points and all that stuff. But mechanically, if the body doesn't have the capacity to actually make that shot accurate, you're never going to be able to do it.
So it's kind of like random, like pistol shooting almost, where, you know, I see the target and then I bring it up and, you know, obviously like, let's say you had like a big orange front sight. I really like the Trigicon, like as HD, like bright orange sight. Mm-hmm. So as you bring it up, I see the target and I bring it up into my, you know, point of view or field of view. And I'm pretty much just like seeing through, like seeing the target. And then when I see the bead where I need it to, mm-hmm. like I'm not focusing on that front sight. I'm focusing on the target. You just kind of pull and press play. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it similar to
shooting skeet and trap with like the shotgun, that like they can see the bead, or are they trying to, or are they focusing the bead on this, or are they focusing on that, trying to put the bead on it?
You know? The focus is on the periphery, actually. So everything in the background is in focus. Your gun barrel and your bead is blurry.
Gotcha.
Right. So your eyes are looking for the flash of the orange
target. So it's just like the pistol.
Yeah. And you're trying to essentially match that speed. Right. And actually have a good follow through within everything versus trying to focus on the BB. That's never going to make you accurate.
Okay. Right. I just didn't know if there was like different mechanics or whatever, but I just haven't shot enough skeet and trap and all that, you know, I mean, just to be proficient at it. I mean, I'm decent enough with like anticipation. Mm-hmm. So like, I know, like if I can see it fly, I'm pretty good on like, if I can see it once, I'll know like, all right, dude, at this point I need to be here, how fast it's moving.
Well, and that's one of the things that I had to learn, because in Pennsylvania, I grew up bird hunting. Right. And so when I shot trap and skeet with my dad, it was as a training modality to be a better shot with the birds. Mm-hmm. And the way that we shot that was like, okay, you see the bird, you point at it, you shoot it. So it's like this point and shoot mechanism, which in competition shooting, it's not like that. It's more so about the efficiency, the mechanics of your gun movement and working with the lead and working with follow through, because you know the general direction the target's going to be going in.
Sure.
Right. So you can kind of gamify it a little bit.
Whereas more. Birds don't always fly. No. Like they'll be like, boop, boop, boop. Yeah, I know I've been
especially
pheasant.
Especially different types of birds too. Yeah,
I've been duck hunt or pheasant and quail hunting, and like all of a sudden like they go and then, you know, go back the other way. And
yeah. That's nature. It makes it way more fun. Yeah. I'll have to bring my over under out here next time. There has to be a sporting clays course or something around here.
There is. The place that we went is over off of like Route 12, kind of down in Wimberley, where I went to this charity shoot. Mm-hmm. It was great. Amin, who's my buddy, who is an immunologist, has you know, obviously a local clinic, and the group that we went to, they raise money for like cleft palate surgery. And so he donated and we got to go shoot, which was a lot of fun. We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to Field Strong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/fieldstrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show. I wish I had not planned my day so dense. So I do another podcast for Men's Journal called The Everyday Warrior on Fridays. And so that starts at 11:30. So we shot from like, I want to say 9 to like 11. And then I had to jump in the car and it was like 34 minutes and I had like 30 minutes to get there. And so I jetted out. But what was great was we shot and then they had a second flight and then those dudes just sat around and drank.
Yes.
And like ate tacos and had this like amazing time. So my buddy, so I was like, I gotta go. Jumped in the car and took off, and they stayed until like 4. There was like open bar. There was like a taco truck and they got to shoot. And then they had this like bitchin' charity auction where they like, you know, raffle, and they were giving away shotguns. And like, I was like, shit, I shouldn't have planned my day so dense. I should have planned for this a little bit better.
Give yourself some more freedom.
Well, I have this terrible idea that I can squeeze much more into my day than I should.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Did you ever, God, I can't remember the guy's name. It's like Grant Cardone.
Grant Cardone.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who like, you know, I made $1 billion and now you pay me all this money, I'll show you how. Like, I don't know if that stuff is accurate.
He's a great pontificator.
Yeah, but he was on a podcast and he's like, I have 4 days. I have a 12-day week. And he's like, from 6 to 12, day one. From 12 to 4, day 2. From 4 to 8, day 3. From 8 to 8 to 11, day 4. I've had 4 days. That's how hard I work. I do 4 days to every one of your days. And by the end of the week, I've had 28 days. And I'm just like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? And he was like, 6 to this. And he was like snapping his fingers. And like the guys that were on the podcast with him were just like couldn't fucking get it in. And I'm like, this is absolutely insane. Yeah. Like, he's like, you know, I'm booking you on day 9. You know, it happens to just be on Tuesday at noon. Like, I was like,
why are you making this so difficult?
Yeah. I mean, but it
interesting.
Was,
my,
it was
mindset
so
shift though, right?
Like clickbaity that like it, he sucked me into it. And that's the reason I know who he is. Mm-hmm. He was just like, and then my second day and then my third, and he was like snapping his fingers. He's like, look at that. I've outworked you. Do you know why? Cause I had 28 days to year 7.
Think he got that from West Side Story?
I don't fucking know. I was like, are we going to start fighting?
Sharks and Jets.
Oh, dude. That guy. I like still to this day, like if I ever meet him, I'll be like, okay, explain to me, like if it's an 8-hour work day, so you're squeezing your 8 hours into 4, but then you're just doing multiple work days. Are the other people you're working with know on this? Or they just think you have like a 2 o'clock meeting?
Like, are they on board?
Yeah.
I think you're just as crazy as we do.
I'm going to try to, like when we do this pod, I'll get Jason or Jacob to cut it in because it's so, he's like, and he's just snapping his fingers. And I'm like,
I don't know.
Every time.
I think we just did a really great rendition of it.
I think every time that you just need to have a new day and being like, okay, it's 10 a.m., day 2. Hey, we're on day 4. You saw me snap my fingers 3 times. We're on day 5. And then like this, I was on day 6. Like, oh, magic. Dude, it is hilarious. But that's why the guy's like, you know, making billions of dollars. He found a way to have more days. But long story short, I'm trying to do the Grant Cardone and pack as many days as I can. So I'm like, okay, dude, I shoot skeet day 1. Did that podcast day 2. Day 3, I came home and worked on the cars. Day 4, I ran my track loader and replaced scent. I had 4 days on my Friday.
So then you're done for the week, right? Is that how that works?
If I only want to work a 5-hour day, that means I just work Monday and then Tuesday morning. But
now we're getting into the Tim Ferriss like 4-hour work week thing. So kind of, I think you might be confusing the two.
Man, is that really even a thing? Think it was just a really good name for a book to sell a lot of books, trying to convince the people that you only had to work 4 hours a week by automating everything?
I think that he has great intentions of helping people try to do more with less and to really prioritize and make their day more efficient. I get that intention behind it too. Well, but
I do run into people that are like, I don't respond to emails until from like 12 to 1.
Which boundary setting, right?
It's not a bad thing. But the problem with a business a lot like what we do here at Power Athlete, which is very customer service heavy, that like, I mean, and I'm so guilty of this. This is like, I raise my hand. I'm fucking guilty that if I send somebody an email, like if I have a question about something, I shoot somebody an email and I don't get an email response back, what I assume is like within acceptable time. Mm-hmm. And I have to go back and reread the thread to figure out why I sent you the email. To me, that just speaks about poor customer service. Sure. Yeah. So I feel like for people that shoot us emails, if you know, there's a, 48 hours is not an acceptable time to wait. 24 hours is probably the max. Like I like to get things done at least, you know, if it's 5-6 hours, like I look and I'm like, you know, I mean, if somebody shoots me a deal at midnight, they're probably not going to get something back until the next day, if I shoot an email at midnight, I don't expect something back.
No.
If I shoot an email at like noon and I don't get something by the end of the day, I'll be like, what the fuck? Who are these people? Mm-hmm. Bunch of hacks. And I don't know if that's like boundary centering or whatever it is, but I expect there's a certain cadence to responding to questions.
I think you just have to set the expectations, right? Like if you set a 24-hour rule, abide by that 24-hour rule. I have the same thing, but like that would never work for me because I have clients from all over the world. Like I'm working in so many different time zones from Australia to Europe and Asia and everything like that, that like my day has to be kind of segmented around those, right? And understand like where they're coming from, like when their mornings are my nights and stuff like that. So their expectations are a little bit different as well. But like we had that conversation up front and most people are really understanding of it. But I do save time for myself because like you, I need to train in the morning.
Yeah.
And so from the hours of like 5 a.m. till 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, that's me time.
Yeah.
You do not get to interrupt that me time.
Yeah,
because I need that for my own health, number one, but then two, my own mental health too.
Sure.
Like I like the weight room is my dojo. I use that to release energy and everything like that. Same thing with going out and shooting sporting clays. It's the same way. Like I just need to get out there and blow some shit up.
Well, right? I mean, also it helps you be proficient at what you work with people.
Well, that too.
You know, I mean,
well, and that's my biggest thing too. Even with like physical therapists and stuff in the different spaces of athletics, like, you need to understand the basics of what your athletes are going through.
Yeah.
Right. I think that makes you really, really good at your job to be able to feel what they're feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I may not be shooting skeet at an Olympic level, but I know how to do a low mount on a gun. I know how to go from the waist up to the shoulder.
Sure.
I know how to mount a gun.
Well, it allows you to have an intelligent conversation.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, and whether it be any of the athletes that we work with that do different sports, you know, for example, These guys that were, I'm working with a group that's doing what's called Drake's Passage, Drake's mm-hmm. Fury, where they're going to take a rowboat from Antarctica to Chile. So 645 miles, yeah. Six dudes in a boat, three of them row at a time.
Sounds like a great time.
Yeah. So that stretch of water is the most treacherous mm-hmm. ocean. It's basically taken more lives because, you know, the reason they put in the Panama Canal was because that was where they would have to sail around. Mm-hmm. So it's a super treacherous deal, and I don't know why it's called Drake's Passage, because I don't think Sir Francis Drake did it, but that's just what it's known as. Mm-hmm. And these guys, I think it was Colin O'Grady, and there's another like the greatest open water paddler, mm-hmm. Rower is a guy from Iceland. I can't remember his name. He's got a bitch in TED Talk. He and Colin O'Grady put a team together of like these badass Olympic rowers, and they did it, I think, in 12 days. Mm-hmm. So this group of SEALs through the Legacy, Seven Legacies, which also did that. I don't know if you saw, they jumped into seven continents mm-hmm. in 7 days. So they kind of do these different challenges to try to like raise money for, you know, SEAL Foundation and other stuff. So they put this, they're going to try to beat that record.
Yeah.
So they came to us to help them with their training. So we had a training camp for them. And, you know, I mean, I'm not a rower by any means, but I've spent a ton of time on the C2 and we know mm-hmm. about buffering. So we brought in a guy to test lactate and VO2 max mm-hmm. and started really just putting them into a model where now they're trying to make them the most strongest, durable motherfuckers we can. And it was actually good because one of the guys is a high level rower. And, you know, I got a chance to like, he took him through some technique stuff and just like, you know, what you had to do. But it was neat putting him into mm-hmm. our training model. He actually, when we did the Tabata Eco Bike, he hit 84 calories, which was fucking impressive.
That's good.
So, but I do think it helps to have a little bit of intrinsic knowledge Absolutely. Of the sport at which you're teaching. So at least to have a proficient conversation. So I completely agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had no knowledge of shooting and had don't shoot yourself and they were like, you know, and you're like trying to pontificate and give them this yes. information, you know, it just comes off as disingenuous. It's yes. kind of like if I go to you for an ACL rehab and you're in poor physical shape as a physical therapist, like, I don't know if I'm buying in on this.
There's a lack of integrity there. And even if you don't say something up front, like it's innately felt, like yeah. you feel that as a human being.
Yeah. It just feels disingenuous. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's probably very similar. I mean, like football coach is a little bit different, but I always thought that like, you know, when coaches are out there screaming at you in the middle of the summer when it's hot mm-hmm. and this, and they're in t-shirts and, you know, screaming and yelling and you're in full gear playing it. I just thought that that was always kind of a little disingenuous if the dude never played the sport. It was a little bit different if the guy had played at a high level and had done mm-hmm. it. I could take that. But if you had never played football, I'm like, I don't know if I fucking buy this.
Yeah. There's no believability there.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's ethos.
Correct.
You got to have ethos.
Yeah. With ethos, pathos, and logos, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, the ethos to credibility part is maybe the easiest to build by getting out there and doing the damn thing and like showing up every day and putting in the effort and making the connections that allow you to build that up. And then, you know, the logos is the knowledge base. We can learn that through books and through, you know, hands-on experience and getting the reps in. But I do believe that that pathos is often the most difficult to actually help somebody train up.
Really? Right.
Mm-hmm. You have to be able to evoke emotion in someone. And that, I think, comes down to communication skills and be able to build a connection with somebody and build rapport and trust. It's the soft art, right? It's the soft skills that not a lot of people take the time to actually to train and to actually invest a lot of time into building.
Do you think that pathos is stemmed, like it really is stemmed, I think, with vulnerability and authenticity.
Absolutely.
That, you know, like the pathos, like, so like the pathos is like the emotional appeal, yeah. right? So like you're appealing to the emotion. It helps all the others. Like if you have like the ethos, like, you know, I'm like a Rush, who's one of our fighters, is down with Victor competing in mm-hmm. Brazil at the Brasileiros. And, you know, a Rush texted me today and we were kind of going back and forth a little bit. And he's like, man, I wish you were here. And I was like, yeah, I wish I was there too, man. You know why? Because I'd have you chewing glass before you yes. went out there. I'm like a good hype man. Like back in the day, I don't know if you're a fan of boxing, but I think it was Julio Cesar Chavez mm-hmm. had a this old Mexican dude who was like one of his cut men in his ring, was in his corner guys. And what the guy would do is he would tape pictures of like, it was Julio Cesar Chavez or whoever he was working with. He would take pictures of their family or their kids. He'd cut them out mm-hmm. and he would tape them to his head like a crown.
so that the whole time that he's like coaching you in this yeah. and you're walking out doing everything, you're seeing your family. Oh, and man. Like, I
talk
always
about
thought,
an emotional
oh
appeal
my Holy God, crap. I always like my brother and I, that was our wow. favorite dude. Like whenever we'd watch boxing, we'd be like, where is he? Mm-hmm. And the fact that his job was to tape your family mm-hmm. on his head was like the coolest thing. That dude's like, you know what? You need motivation of taping your head. Mm-hmm. And so I texted that to Arash. I'm like, you know, I would have to, you know, tape pictures of like hot chicks or, you know, whatever it is. We just like tape that around there. Harry Shaw would be in there and just like, just making jokes to them. But I really think that like, there's an interesting relationship between like, you know, whether you're a coach or a PT or mm-hmm. you're, you know, an individual that is tasked with helping them improve their performance, that there has to be some form of like emotional symbiotic relationship mm-hmm. where they have to feel like you want them to be the best version of themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and whether or not we're kind of wired to like be pleasers or, and you can go through this whole thing, at the end of the day, you want the people that you're working for or with you mm-hmm. to want you to do the best that they can. And you want to feel that like they're invested in you the same way you're investing in them. And if that relationship doesn't exist, I don't think that it allows people to really reach their maximal potential.
Right. You're speaking to one, compassion and empathy. You need to be able to build those skills, but then also have an equal and energetic exchange, right? So the energy that I'm putting into you, you need to be able to give back to me as well. And a lot of that is built through feeling and the compassion, the empathy component. And you could be a hype man, but you know, it doesn't need to be that. You don't need to be a cheerleader. Like I had one of my junior athletes who was competing to get onto a junior team, and he shot a really bad first round. And he got into his head and was starting to think about all the mechanical stuff. And I'm like, Josh, listen, you got all the skill that you need, right? Just go out there, ground through your feet, feel your breath, and pull the fucking trigger. And guess what happened? 3 perfect scores after that.
Nice.
Right? Like, so it's simple because we've built a connection over 2 years. He trusts me. Yeah. And I gave him a little bit of tough love there, which is exactly what he needed. But that's where it's, I don't know if this is actually a trainable skill or not. Maybe you can give me your opinion on this.
You mean as a coach or an athlete?
As a coach.
Okay.
Of being able to understand the way that your athlete's brain thinks and what they need in that moment. Right? Because I think that has to do with a lot of, once again, an awareness piece around that. But I just don't know if like you can actually teach somebody how to do that.
No. I think you have that inherent.
Yeah.
I suck as a husband and a father in that way. Like, you know, my wife comes to me with like a problem and like I'm a fixer. So if my wife like comes to me and is like, hey, this and this, what I start doing is I start giving like advice or like trying to solve the problem.
Yeah.
And I ask now where I'm like, you know, and I'd like to learn from my mistakes. Mm-hmm. And now my whole deal is like, I hear what you're saying. Like, I agree with you. Like, this is a you know, like, this is a shitty situation. Yeah. Like, do you want me to help you solve the situation or you just need me to like listen to vent?
Yes.
So that's like been an interesting piece. But then the other thing too is, you know, like, you know, my wife got sick this week. Mm-hmm. Jamie went to Jits and I think she brought something home and she got Cash and my wife sick. Or actually, I think she got Cash. Cash, he got sick and then my wife got sick. And so she's been battling something mm-hmm. and I know she's not feeling good. And like, I try to like help and like, hey, okay, yes. I'll do this and this. So I'm trying to like fix it instead of being like, I'm sorry, you're not feeling good.
Yes.
Like, how can I make you feel better? And so, like I'm in this constant state of learning because my mind doesn't work like with, it's not sympathy, but I'm not like, my mind doesn't work like that. I think like, hey, you're not feeling good. All right, like how can I help to make things a little bit easier or what can I do? Like, do you need to go to the doctor? This, so I'm like constantly trying to fix these problems. And like sometimes people just need like, hey dude, I know you're going through a hard time or this kind of sucks or this, but then having the ability to be like vulnerable enough to be like, yeah, dude, I don't feel good or mm-hmm. something bad's happening or like this isn't what I'm expecting. Like how do we get past this so that we can all live our best versions? Yeah. And I think for your athletes, you're in an interesting piece because, you know, if they're not performing, do they need like the velvet glove or do they need the fucking velvet hammer?
Yes.
You know, like, you know, hey, dude, you got this. I believe in you. We've done the work. Or do they need to like, you need to fucking get your shit together. I'm going to fucking punch you in your mm-hmm. face. And like it's an interesting dilemma to like know when to use each one. And I think that only comes down to like empathy, emotional intelligence, or just fucking being highly, highly switched on.
You got to feel more and think less in those moments. It's the way I think about it anyway, because it's about being attuned attunement into other people's energies and the way that they're expressing themselves, right? So it's no fault of your own that you want to fix things. That's like an innate masculine energy. I'm the same way. Like, I'm definitely a white knight. Like, let me help you solve the problem. Like, I want to make this better.
Yeah.
But you're right. 9 times out of 10, you don't need to do any of that. Simple acknowledgement will get you a very, very long way, where it's like you can feel something's off. And if you just simply say, hey, I understand, I know how you're feeling right now, and maybe that sucks, or, you know, maybe this isn't the best, you know, you probably don't like the way you're feeling right now, and leave it at that. And then sometimes even just giving somebody a hug.
Yeah.
It's simple enough to just diffuse an entire situation. And I think that's a tough skill to really develop, because it takes a lot of our, I think, genetic engineering and having to override it. Especially as men, anyway.
Yeah.
As far as coaching is concerned.
Well, I think there's what is it like? There's that I can't remember the strength coach or who it is, but it's like chop wood, carry water, kind of a deal. Like, it's basically kind of a similar premise to like move the dirt.
Yeah.
There's, you know, if there's a problem or something needs to be solved, I believe that there is a tool for it. There's, you know, if I don't have it in the shop, I can go get it. If it needs to be fixed, like, there's a way to kind of construct and kind of continue to move. And I don't like when, like, all of a sudden things run to a head and they stop. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, if you're not feeling good and there's all of this stuff that needs to go, and either somebody has to pick it up or you got to, you know, so like there's a constant piece. Yep. But you think for your athletes, you know, you've done this work. We've been here before. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, especially with young athletes, you have to remind them of the work that they've done and how far they've come, mm-hmm. so that they start feeling that they're part of a bigger process. Yes. Like that old dude taping pictures of your kids on his head, so that as you're remembering why you're walking out there. I'm just not walking out there for glory. I'm walking out because, you know, these people are the people that I'm doing this for. You know, people, you know, use boxing to fight out of poverty and mm-hmm. to fight oppression. And so you're part of this bigger thing. You're just not going out there. Are you a prize fighter, or are you just trying to go out there and fight on the street? No, these guys are prize fighters. They're going out to fight the best dude in the world in front of, you know, tens of thousands of people for money. And you have to remember why you're doing it at every step. Mm-hmm. You know, as Marcus Aurelius said, you know, at every moment, ask yourself, is this necessary? Which is, you know, that guy, he needed to see his family to be it necessary. So I think a lot of times with these athletes, and whether it be, you know, pro football players or baseballs or the Jits guys or your shooters, I think they have to remember at every moment why this is necessary and why they were doing this and why they're here and what the, like, intended outcome. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not just training you to be okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not training you just to go out there and give it the old college try. I'm training you to be the best in the world. And this is the deal that we've made. I'm going to bring my best magic. I'm going to bring my best mojo, and I'm going to give it to you. And your ability to put it into, whether it be your fists, your hands, however it looks, whether a weapon, and be able to, you know, have that receipt for success. Because as I tell my young fighters all the time, I want you to stand with your face in the sun. Mm-hmm. I stood with my face in the sun for 10 years on NFL sidelines. And when it was the middle, you know, at noon, you know, Kansas City, 1 p.m. in Philadelphia, on cold days, on hot days, to stand there, close your eyes and feel the sun warm your face, and know that you're going to go out there and do something that only a few people in the world ever get a chance to do, and do it at a level that a few people have ever done. That is what, like, there's nothing better than that. Yeah. And I want that for our young fighters. I want it for your shooters. I want everybody to have their moment to stand with their face in the sun. And if you're very few people get to do it at that level. And I think connecting that with your young, you know, with your shooters and this, and being like, I'm not doing this for you to be okay. We're doing this work to make you win a gold medal. I mean, can you imagine standing there on the podium with a gold medal, seeing your flag come up and hearing the national anthem,
there's
and knowing
nothing else like
no.
it?
No. Adam Nelson tells the story, and like, dude, like, gave me goosebumps. I mean, it was something I never got a chance to do, just because it wasn't ever something in my, in my path. But, you know, I mean, there's, you know, many examples of it, but I got to stand, like I said, I got to stand with my face in the sun for a decade, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And I miss it every single day. But what I don't want to do, because sometimes, all too up times, hindsight's 20/20, and we have the clairvoyance of age to look back and see what the young cannot.
and to see this opportunity and to see these guys have this amazing opportunity and want that for them. And we were talking about this the other day, when you get to a point as a coach where you want it more than your athlete does. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you like become so emotionally invested in their success because you want them to be the best. And you know that if they are the best and they can compete on the biggest stage, all of the accolades that come, I mean, fucking, you know, roses fall from heaven, fucking pearly gates open, you know, fucking velvet ropes fly aside, skirts shoot up. I mean, it's this amazing thing to be the best and to walk in and be like, I know I'm fucking the best. Mm-hmm. And I want that for all the athletes who work with and all the people. Like, I want, like, you know, talking about the Drake's Passage guys, like, I'm not training you just to do okay. We're going there to do this because I want you to put that flare up and be like, we set the world record. We did something that only a few other humans on the earth have done. And I think like that ascension towards greatness and mastery, I was fortunate to do it myself, and I just want to be part of somebody else's parade helping them do it now.
Yeah,
because I don't get to do it the same way. And if I can at least take them on that journey, it allows me to maybe have a little bit of sunshine on mm-hmm. my face.
Yeah. And that sunshine on your face helped you recenter and refocus on your mission and your purpose, which was greater than the game that day. Right. And I think that's one of our roles, which you're alluding to now as a coach. Our main role is to help be that anchor and to help be that compass to direct them down that path. And like, I'm not like you, I didn't get to experience that at such a high level, but I know that my purpose here on this earth is to help others do that.
Yeah,
and you're keeps doing, driving me forward too.
You're doing, I think anybody who works to get people out of pain, mm-hmm. this is an interesting piece, man. Like, so I always was sideways on chiropractors and ART mm-hmm. and people. Like, they were like, oh, you know, you're in pain, just stop training, we'll get you out of pain. That's not getting people out of pain. All you're doing is removing the stimulus for their lives, and you're just basically short-circuiting it. Training, getting in better shape, moving better, like working through, like still being able to live your life. Like, if we just like, what was that movie, Surrogates, where the people were just at home and they had yeah. robots moving around? Those people weren't in any pain. Mm-hmm. Like, they were just sitting at home and had somebody else go out for them. But I think the true expression and the nature of what you're doing is helping people move through dysfunction, avoid pain by fixing and finding efficient human movement that allows them to go out and do the best thing that they can do in this world. And to me, I don't know if there's anything better than that.
No, that's a beautiful way to wrap this thing up.
Yeah, I will end it here. Yeah. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market.
We've built our online training business by partnering with Train Heroic and helping us deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jackstreet, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training.
And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best tech and training, go to trainheroic.co/powerathletehq.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.